I'm Susan Glasser. Welcome back to the Global Politico. This week we have a very special guest who's joining us, Ambassador Dan Fried. 1 week ago, he retired as America's longest-serving diplomat. For 40 years, he's worked as an American Foreign Service officer, a career that has spanned the arc of the Cold War at its coldest, the remarkable end of the Cold War in 1989, and the years of disillusionment and difficulty that followed. Dan left office as he has occupied it with incredible insight and clarity about the nature of America's position in the world. He gave a rousing speech. I'll read you a few quotes from it to start off our conversation. He talked about his experience of 40 years in the American Foreign Service and the long arc of it covering the Soviet Union and then the remarkable collapse of the Soviet Union and everything that's come since over the last 25 years. Nothing, he said, can be taken for granted. And this great achievement is now under assault by Russia. But what we did in my time is no less honorable. It is for the present generation to defend, and when the time comes again, extend freedom in Europe. Dan, thank you so much for being with us today. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. You are a man liberated, if not entirely, at least partially. So I'd love to talk to you a little bit about what that going away speech was like for you, why you decided to speak out and say what you did.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. My farewell speech really took 40 years to write, and it turned out I did have something to say. I wanted to speak out about what I consider to be America's grand strategy in the world. And we often talk about what the United States did after 1945, building the liberal world order on the ruins of World War II, and after 1989, when we extended freedom in Europe to help the 100 million liberated Europeans, and that's all good. But the American tradition of foreign policy exceptionalism, our grand strategy as a nation, reaches back much further. Really, at the end of the 19th century, when we achieved power a generation after the Civil War, the outlines of an American vision came into focus. And it was based on two things. One, our realization that our values and our interests were the same, and that our business interests would advance as our values advanced in the world. And the second precept of the American grand strategy is that our security and prosperity didn't work unless other nations were also secure and prosperous. There had to be something in it for them. So we weren't looking simply to grab territory or widen our sphere of influence or anything like that. We wanted to make the world a better place and get very rich in the process. That's the American grand strategy, a combination of breathtaking ambition, apparent naivete, but actual insight, and it worked out in the 20th century. I wanted to talk about that, and I also wanted to talk about America's identity.
A lot of people here in Washington have been worrying, not just since President Trump came into office, but certainly with an accelerating or escalating decibel level since President Trump came into office, that this is a moment that is the end of the liberal order that you celebrate. You wrote in your goodbye speech, "Our mistakes, blunders, flaws, and shortcomings notwithstanding, the world America made after 1945 and 1989 has enjoyed the longest period of general peace in the West since Roman times and decades of prosperity." A lot of people now think it's on the way out the door. Tony Blinken, who was the Deputy Secretary of State, called it a powerful defense of the liberal international order. Clarion call for the United States to lead is what Damon Wilson, one of your colleagues from the Bush administration, had to say about it. How worried are you that this is the end of the liberal international order?
I don't believe it's the end. I believe the liberal international order is under assault from Russia and from other authoritarian regimes, and it is being questioned from within the West. by nationalists, by nativists, and by people who doubt the values of the West. But we've gone through periods like this before in the 70s after Vietnam and Watergate, and certainly in the 30s when people thought liberal democracy was dead and the future belonged either to the fascists or the communists.
But the thing that's surprising about this, right, is that it is now at least a faction of the party that controls the American White House, including potentially the president of the United States himself, who seems to be the ones attacking the liberal order that, in fact, the United States not only largely built and secured, but has benefited disproportionately from. That's different.
It is different, and it's unusual because Republicans, Reagan, but also George W. Bush, believed in freedom, and they believed in America's role. To have the governing party speak in terms of a zero-sum world or speak in terms of America's purpose as no more than grabbing the largest share possible in the short run goes against our foreign policy tradition that goes back to 1900, really.
So that's, again, this is what's so remarkable about this moment here in Washington. It's hard to convey fully to people who are outside of it, right? That's why you see it, a very almost nonpartisan reaction, right? You know, you have conservatives, liberals, people who are used to arguing with each other, who are now making common cause in their concern about this potential break with decades of American foreign policy. Give us a little bit of a sense about what things are like, you know, inside the State Department these days. Trump not only ran against the foreign policy establishment, there's a lot of questions about his proposed budget cuts of up to 37% of the State Department's budget. He hasn't hired a lot of people. There's a lot of uncertainty. What is it like to feel that your profession is under attack by the leadership?
Well, the Foreign Service and the State Department have always been a punching bag for a certain part of the political spectrum. I don't take that too seriously yet. The issue is a larger one. We hear the phrase America first, and that from the president. Of course we should keep our country's interests uppermost in mind. No argument there. But what does it mean to say America first? How do we understand our interests in a narrow short-term sense? Are we merely going to be a schoolyard bully that steals other kids' lunch money? Or do we think in bigger, more ambitious terms? And it seems to me a broader, not a narrow vision of America's interest is a one which suits our nation and has worked out for us well. So I think apart from the nervousness about budgets and personnel and all the rest of it, there's an underlying concern that we're losing sight of what, to use the phrase, made America great.
Well, I should point out, and it's really a very crucial point, you are a classic representative of a kind of person who may or may not exist, 20 years from now in Washington, but has a long tradition in the Foreign Service. You've served presidents of all parties starting, I believe, back in 1977. You joined the Foreign Service when Jimmy Carter was still president. You worked under Reagan, the first Bush, Clinton, the second Bush, Obama, and very briefly, under Donald Trump. You worked very closely with many of those presidents. And, it's interesting that you were able to have high-ranking positions in both the administration of Bill Clinton, but also the administration of George W. Bush. How is that possible in this partisan age?
I didn't change my views, and I didn't change the kinds of policies I recommended. But both Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush did the same thing in Europe. Both of them, very different personalities, advanced freedom. And they did so not to hem in Russia, but to respond to the interests and both of America, the West in general, and those 100 million Europeans from the Baltic to the Black Sea, the Poles, the Czechs, the Balts, and others who wanted to live in security. And both presidents helped realize a Europe whole, free, and at peace. That was a pretty good achievement, and I was proud to be part of it.
And they weren't suspicious of you?
Oh, well, the Bush people at first thought I was a Clinton person. The Obama people thought I was a Bush person. God knows what the current team thinks. I don't think they've thought about me at all. But it's interesting. George W. Bush did not care about partisanship, not at all. It's interesting that the Bush administration kept on holdovers from the Clinton administration and treated them quite well. President Bush once teased me about not being a Republican, which I will not confirm or deny because partisanship is not part of my professional makeup, but he didn't care. What he cared about is, are you going to do your job? Are you serious about it? And what are your policy values?
Probably he wanted to know what was really going on behind the scenes in the Clinton White House anyways, right? Was he trying to get the scoop out of you?
I didn't have much idea about the Oval, but I did know President Clinton, and I thought he made some crucial right decisions. And it is just interesting that both Presidents Clinton and Bush came out the same way on the crucial issues of the time.
Defined as what?
I mean about NATO enlargement, about support for European Union enlargement, and support for in Clinton's time, the newly liberated peoples of Europe.
All right. So I want to roll up our sleeves and really talk about Russia, because that is the thread that runs through a lot of your career. And I should say that, you know, you started out when it was the Soviet Union. You were in Leningrad before it turned back to St. Petersburg. You met with and knew the refuseniks back in the beginning of your career as a Foreign Service officer. You then switched. You became the ambassador to Poland and, were a key figure in that country's transformation from its communist days to maybe you couldn't have even envisioned its role as a pillar of both NATO and the EU today. But, you know, Poland, then you came back here to the United States. You basically mastered and worked inside the National Security Councils under Clinton and Bush. And then, of course, were the Assistant Secretary for Europe in the middle of a very difficult period during the Iraq War, as well as some key moments during the U.S. relationship with Russia, I think, when George W. Bush was really souring on or changing his view about Russia. And then, of course, in the Obama administration, in many ways, right, the last few years of your portfolio have been some of the toughest jobs handed to you. You have been working both on the closure of Guantanamo Bay.
I want to ask you about that,
and getting prisoners to be accepted by other countries as part of the effort, the unsuccessful effort by Barack Obama to close it. And then, of course, the last couple of years, you've worked on perhaps the even harder issue of sanctions against Russia after its invasion of Ukraine and takeover of the Crimea and its activities in eastern Ukraine. So basically, you've had a knack for getting in the middle of some very difficult issues, and Russia is the common theme throughout. Let's start at the end first, though, and talk about sanctions. What is going on with them and President Trump?
Well, our sanctions policy remains intact. And it will remain intact until it changes, if it does. And I'm not sure it will. It is certainly true, and it is puzzling to me, that during the campaign, the Trump people spoke both consistently positive terms about President Putin and in skeptical terms about sanctions. It's puzzling to me. Russia committed an act of aggression in Ukraine, and that's the first time since 1945 a European country has seized the territory of another European country. That's serious business. They started a war with their neighbor. Their troops, as well as the separatists funded and controlled by Russia, are killing people just about every day. The West responded with sanctions, and the West responded with unity. I think that unity probably kept things from getting worse, and they could have been much worse. They gave the Ukrainians time to resist. And I think the sanctions have helped push the Russians into accepting, at least in theory, a framework for solving the eastern Ukrainian problem, if not yet the Crimean problem. So sanctions are a strong and agreed element of the West's response to Russia's aggression. It is, as I said, puzzling to me that there is so much skepticism about the sanctions. I don't understand it.
Well, it goes back to this question of, A, how seriously do you view Russia's intervention in the American elections? Is this something that we should really be spun up to DEFCON 5 over here in the United States and in our political system, which is right now pretty much in a tizzy over this?
I don't have any particular inside knowledge. I've read the unclassified and the classified version of the report, but I don't have any inside knowledge. But I will say this. Russia despises the West and is doing what it can to weaken the West. What they did in our election is no different from what they appear to be doing with respect to a number of European elections coming up. They are using the tools at their disposal to weaken Western solidarity, to create doubt, to support nationalist parties, just as the old Soviets supported leftist parties. We need a united Western response to this multi-pronged threat. Now, I am not against working with Russia in areas of common interest at the same time. We're smart enough, or we should be smart enough, to have a dual-track policy, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time. George W. Bush tried working with the Russians after 9/11. Obama had the reset. Both presidents achieved less than they wanted, but both achieved something. Those policies made sense. And it's to the credit of both Presidents Bush and Obama that even as they reached out to Russia, they did not sacrifice core American interests or core American values. We didn't give the Russians on the altar of better relations other countries. We were able to do two things at once. And that reminds me of what Reagan did, best Soviet policy we ever had. Ronald Reagan reached out to Gorbachev at the same time we were pushing back against the Soviets all over the world. He was able to do two things at once, and it worked out very well for us. So there's nothing wrong when the Trump administration says it wants to find areas of common ground to work with Russia. Perfectly reasonable. The question is, are you going to pay the Russians in advance for the privilege of working with them in areas that are supposed to be of common interest? And that I don't see the American interest in doing so.
Did you have anyone ever explain this to you? Were you able to ever have any time where you heard from former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn in his 24 days in office?
No, I never met with him. I won't go into any details of meetings I was in when I was still in office, except to say that I never heard any explanation. I didn't even hear an explanation with which I disagreed. I heard no explanation for why it would be in our interest to unilaterally abandon Ukraine or unilaterally weaken the sanctions. Now, let's take for a moment what might be, and I'm not saying it is, but what might be the Trump administration grand strategy. Let's say that ISIS, that they're right, that ISIS is the near-term threat, and that the midterm challenge is managing the rise of China. There's some evidence that that's the thinking of the administration. That's a perfectly reasonable approach. Well, if that's the case, then you surely want to have a united West to deal with both, and you want to have Russia alongside, but maybe not this Russia while it's busy trying to undermine your chief asset, which is a united West. You want to be able to push back against Russia now, the better to work with them later. So show some patience. And don't be so desperate to rub up against a Russia which is busy trying to do us in all over the world.
Well, it's interesting. You know, they didn't consult with you, obviously, and it sounds like you haven't even heard from their own sort of their own formulation of this shift that they have talked about, but only in very general terms. If President Trump had come to you for the exit interview that you and I are now having, what would
unlikely.
You – unlikely. Unlikely. Let's stipulate. But perhaps it's not unlikely that, you know, you'll hear from General McMaster now that he's the National Security Advisor. What would you tell them? What is it that you think is missing from the understanding of Russia? You talked about Russia as basically putting under assault the liberal order as it's been constructed.
I would say that Russia comes from a place of deep resentment against the West in general and the United States in particular. They are revanchist because they want back as much of their empire as they can grab, and we need to resist that. At the same time, we should be able to look for areas of common interest. Again, this is the Bush policy and it's the Obama policy. And we should think about the future. That is, Putinism is not necessarily the end state for Russia. Russia has moved in many directions since the early 1980s. We should not assume that Russia is doomed to live according to its worst traditions. In fact, in Russian history, failed efforts at external aggression, when they fail, usually bring on areas of internal reform. And internal reform in Russia would require a better relationship with the West. So why should we assume that that historical pattern in Russia is ended? I'm not talking about regime change. It's not our responsibility and it's not our objective. But if we blunt Russian efforts now to be aggressive, we may be pleasantly surprised by the policy options that become available to us in terms of working with a better Russia. Remember, the American grand strategy works when other countries feel secure, but it doesn't work if we acquiesce in the aggression of other countries.
Well, I think you would never really define Russia as secure in its post-Cold War state, right? I mean, you know, it's almost the definition of a kind of a swaggering, an insecure power looking to go outwards.
The Russian myth that they broadcast to the world and have their various surrogates in the West repeat is that somehow the West took advantage of them, that we were mean to them. That writes out of history everything Strobe Talbot and Bill Clinton tried to do with Boris Yeltsin. Strobe Talbot leaned forward, doing everything he could to help the Russians. And frankly, I have little patience for the notion that we gave them nothing but bad advice. The same people the Americans sent over, that we sent over to advise the Russians, we also sent over to advise the Poles about how to build a post-communist economy. Same people, same advice with radically different results, which leads to suspicion. It's not our advice which was the crucial variable. It was the Poles on one hand and the Russians on the other. The Poles succeeded. The Russians didn't. Don't blame us.
You know, it's interesting. You were involved very directly in another key aspect of the Russian complaint today, right? Their complaint, which is that NATO was expanded and enlarged in a way that was meant to kind of threaten and surround them. And you hear this from Putin. You hear this from his top lieutenants. It's been a consistent complaint and theme of Russian nationalists. What was your thinking? And tell us a little bit back in the Clinton administration how that played out. There was a real debate at the time whether that was a good idea or not.
Debate, I would say at the beginning, about 95% of the foreign policy establishment was against it. The argument against was, well, the Russians won't like it and you don't really need it because it's a new world. And that is attractive until the consequences began to emerge. So what message would we have given under this scenario to the Poles, the Czechs, and others that you were going to hang a sign around your neck, property of Russia to be reclaimed when convenient, that they were going to live in a gray zone, that their reward for having been under, having overthrown communism peacefully was that they become part of Russia's outer empire. How is perpetuating the line of the Cold War in America's interest? In political terms, I'll tell you a story. We were in the middle of this debate when Bill Clinton took his first trip to Europe. It was January 1994. He goes to Prague and he meets with the Polish, Czech, Hungarian, and Slovak leadership separately. And you have all four of them pounding him on this very issue. Lech Wałęsa and Václav Havel, very different people with exactly the same message, delivered in somewhat different ways. They said, "What? Are you kidding? Are you kidding? You're going to take this moment in history and you're going to retreat because you're worried about hurting Russia's feelings? We're 100 million Europeans, and you have a chance to finish the work of World War II, of the Atlantic Charter, and you should take it." And the policy that Bill Clinton decided on after getting pounded by these guys.
And how did he react to the pounding, by the way?
Well, he reacted politically, and I mean that as a compliment. He basically said, "Man, this policy is not going to work. You know, I cannot tell these guys to be patient. You got to get me something else." He said basically to Tony Lake, and Tony Lake turned to me and some close colleagues like Nick Burns and Sandy Virchow, and we came up with a dual-track strategy, NATO enlargement, but in parallel, working the NATO-Russia relationship. And the theory was these two tracks could proceed as quickly as possible as these countries were ready, and we put no artificial limit on the NATO-Russia track. I even thought it was conceivable, and you didn't want to shut the door, that Russia could become a member of NATO. You didn't want to rule it out. This was an open period. We didn't know what was going to happen. Now, in the end, it worked out the way it worked out, but it was an open-ended policy, not one designed to hem in Russia. And by the way, while all of this was happening, American military forces in Europe were beginning to be drawn down. This Russian notion of encirclement is, let us say, an alternative fact. It's just flat wrong. The United States pulled back on its military deployments in Europe, and it was perhaps ironic that the Obama administration, which starts out with a reset with Russia, is the administration that's then leads NATO to put in forces into the Baltics and Poland after Russia has started its second war against its neighbors, Georgia in 2008, Ukraine in 2014, and that was enough.
So, okay, you're skipping ahead a little
bit. Yes, I am.
So, okay, so we have NATO enlargement. You're right in the thick of it. Bill Clinton says, "Oh, give me another policy. Give me another policy." You give him another policy, but it's bet hedging because you don't really know, as you said, where things are going to turn out. Now, flash forward to the surprising ascent of Vladimir Putin. A lot of people would say that America's experts got Putin wrong, or at least enough of them did, that our policy basically was not successful in dealing with him.
Well, you know, I was there in the early days after 9/11 when Putin reached out to Bush.
You were at the National Security Council.
I was at the NSC. I was responsible. I was the senior director for Europe and Eurasia, which it for a while included Russia. And I remember these conversations with Condi Rice. She knew Russia very well, and it was possible to make the case that Putin was going to be one of these reassemblers of a Russian state which had fallen on hard times, that he would be a czar restorer in a way, a maybe mildly authoritarian but a modernizer, and able to work with the West, and we would be able to work with him. Now, it didn't turn out that way, but you could in those early days make a reasonable case for that. And so I'm certainly not going to criticize a policy that at the time I supported. And Condi Rice made that case. President Bush had his famous meeting in Slovenia where he looked into his soul. He said that was not in the talking points.
By the way, did you must have known at that moment that it would forever be associated with Bush?
I would say this. I was sitting in the sort of a bleachers watching this with Condi Rice, and when he said that, you could see her just sit up a little bit. Very understated. If you didn't know her, you would have missed it. But I thought, right, that's a novel way of putting it. But President Bush was reaching out to Vladimir Putin. You have to understand what he was trying to do, and it was a reasonable position to take.
When did your view of Putin change? When did you understand just the nature of his project, both in terms of restoring a more authoritarian government inside Russia and also the nature of his views toward the West?
When Putin started going after the independent media.
Well, that was pretty early on.
That was 2002, 2003. And I'll tell you another story. I think that President Bush was ahead of most of his government in realizing that Putin was not the person we thought he was. And I remember a conversation he had with Tony Blair, basically, in October 03 about that. And they were ahead of their advisors. I think President Bush and Prime Minister Blair had understood Putin pretty early. Now, we were still trying to work with them, and there was, as I said, good reason for doing so. I think the real turn came with Putin's very aggressive speech at the Munich Security Conference. That was 10 years ago. It was 07. And I think if we made a mistake of judgment, it was that we didn't fully understand Putin's reaction to the color revolutions. Those were the democratic movements in Georgia and Ukraine and a little bit in Kyrgyzstan, which the Russians thought we had orchestrated. We knew we hadn't, and we dismissed it. But I think we should have understood that Putin took this seriously. The whole thing is laughable to think that at the time we were unable to master political developments in Iraq, despite resources and American troops, that with no budget at all, we would manage a Ukrainian political revolution. I mean, we're not that good. I wish. But Putin thought we were, and I think we did not fully appreciate that.
Well, and both Bush and Obama, right, at various periods of time, believed in scenarios that didn't come to pass when it came to Putin's own behavior in office, right? So Bush and his at least some of his top advisors, including Condi Rice, at times believed that Putin would step out of power. And here we are all these years later, and he's still in power. President Obama clearly hoped that Dmitry Medvedev could be built up to be more of a real leader and not just a leader in name or a placeholder for President Putin. Tell me a little bit about, you know, were they getting bad advice from people?
I went through I wasn't part of it, but I was watching President Obama's reset, and Mike McFaul, our ambassador to Russia and a real Russia expert, was behind that. That was based on an assumption that Medvedev, who was for a time the president of Russia, was a new generation figure and more and better disposed to the West. And frankly, there was some evidence for that. It didn't turn out that way, I realize, but I'm not going to go back and criticize them. There was a reasonable basis for that. And the reset with Russia achieved something, especially, by the way, because Joe Biden, at the very beginning, abounded the reset by saying, yeah, we're not going to recognize Russian dismemberment of Georgia. We're not going to give Russia a veto over NATO membership. But under those conditions, we can do a reset. So the Biden corollary to the reset meant that the Obama administration could proceed with the reset without ever messing up our policy. And Mike McFaul did a pretty good job. It didn't work out. But there are a lot of policies that don't work out that are nevertheless worth doing.
Well, that's an interesting question when you look at this issue of where Putin and Russia are today and this restoration of them as, at least on the European continent, our sort of main adversary. Do you think that was inevitable. I mean, Trump maybe doesn't speak in fully realized policy terms when he talks about this, but he is representing a critique that exists on both the right and the left that somehow the United States, if we'd been more successful in understanding what Putin was doing and encountering it, we wouldn't be in this position today. Is there anything to that? As you retire, are you doing any soul searching on this front?
This is a rhetorical question. What would you have had us do? Not enlarge NATO and the European Union? Well, in that case, we'd be dealing not with the People's Republic of Luhansk, but quite possibly the People's Republic of Narva in Estonia. The Russians were going to come back. I would have regretted it had Strobe Talbot not been so forward-leaning. He was right to do so. It didn't work out, but we were right to try. Could we have done things differently? Maybe, as I said, we should have been more sympathetic to Russia's alarm over the color revolutions. I think that that was – I don't know what we would have done in operational terms different, but we might have realized that earlier. Had we not – Fiona Hill, wise Russia hand, said
– Who's now going to be President Trump's senior director at the National Security Council.
Well, that hasn't been announced, but I've read the press accounts, and I hope it's true because she's just top rate. Mm-hmm. She's excellent and commands respect of just about all the people in the field. But she made the case that American support for Kosovo independence in 2008 was so opposed by the Russians that they were going to take revenge, and this might have been a contributing factor to the Georgian War. And I understand where she's coming from on this, but Russia didn't have real stakes in Kosovo. We had troops there as part of the United Nations mandated mission. Had we not acted in Kosovo, we would have gone from being liberators to being occupiers of a radicalizing population. I'm not going to put a policy which puts our troops at risk and other countries' troops at risk for the sake of not offending the Russians where they don't have any real interests other than sentiment. Can't do it. But anyway, Fiona's great. That was the best news. To hear that she might take that position, best news of the day.
All right. So you worked really pretty closely, or you certainly had a bird's eye seat to watch a number of presidents, both at the crucial period of the end of the Cold War and all the way up
to George H.W. Bush, I don't think has been given sufficient credit for the way he handled the year 1989. He just nailed it. Mm-hmm. At the time, he was criticized for being too reserved and not triumphalist, but his cool tone yet forward-leaning support for Poland and Hungary, who were sort of the first people that were busting through the bars, so to speak, just nailed it. He just nailed it. And it gave – I'll give you a specific. The way he was able to calm some of the Polish communists, his low-key conciliatory approach, I think gave Jaruzelski – the confidence to go ahead and surrender power, which turned out to be I don't know that Jaruzelski could have reversed it, but it could have been bloodier. It could have been worse. I was the Polish desk officer. I was in a low position, but as I met Condi Rice, and I was the one saying communism's coming down in Poland this year. Just watch this space. So she sort of brought me over. I started I'll tell you a story. I couldn't get any papers cleared out of the State Department because I was saying things like communism in Poland is coming down, solidarity is going to win, and I couldn't get that stuff cleared. So one day I said to her, I can't get anything to you. From this moment forward, I work for you. If you want papers to appear on your desk as if by magic, this is a pre-email era, you just let me know. She said, meet me at the checkpoint with a plain brown envelope. And I started feeding her papers.
That's amazing. And that's how the bureaucracy, right? You have to find ways around it.
Well, the only excuse for the insubordination I demonstrated in the spring of 1989 is when you win.
Well, tell me a little bit about the different secretaries of state that you saw. Which ones would you go back and work for again?
Well, I think George Shultz, who was Reagan's secretary of state, put together the best Soviet policy we ever had. And I still go back to some of his precepts. The way he cut through a lot of the nonsense about linkage, that you couldn't work with the Soviets in any area until everything was fine. And he just dismissed that. It was wonderful to watch. He said, no, we either link or we don't link. That's our business. That's our policy. We're going to advance our relations where it is in our interest. It was terrific. So I think George Shultz was one of the great secretaries of state. I think Madeleine Albright understood in her guts the challenge of the moment, which was to extend freedom and the institutions of the West and Central Europe while we had that chance. And she leaned forward. She was the right person at the right time. Just terrific. And honestly, I think Condi Rice was a wonderful Secretary of State. The Bush administration was unpopular in Europe and around the world. And so every time she walked, it's as if every time she walked out of the door, she's in a gale, you know, an ice storm beating on her, and she just went ahead. And she's an example of how a Secretary of State can capture the building and the respect and affection of the whole Foreign Service, which she did.
Well, she was also an example, though, of obviously she was very close to the president himself, and that was a key asset for her when she was going out around the world and representing the White House. People knew that she Sure. was speaking for the president. Obviously, that was also something that Jim Baker had during Bush 41's
That's
presidency.
Right. That's right.
How important is that in the end,
well,
in getting things done?
It was her closeness with the president and her closeness with Steve Hadley, who was the National Security Advisor, meant that the president trusted the State Department and Condi trusted the Foreign Service. She had the confidence to know that people would follow her.
But that it's so interesting, too, because you've seen that's a very different approach than the new Trump White House, in the sense that they, just like the Bush White House, must have known that historically the Foreign Service probably wasn't really on their side, that the invasion of Iraq, as you said, was very unpopular in Europe, but it was also unpopular
Sure.
within your colleagues.
But look what Condi Rice was able to do. Sure, the Iraq war was unpopular, but I'll tell you, the State Department people would have walked 100 miles barefoot through snow for her, and she led them.
And how much were they willing and able to speak their mind when they disagreed with the policy?
She was open to all kinds of views. She had the advantage of being secure, both bureaucratically, her relationship with the president, but intellectually secure. And she knew perfectly well what the criticisms were. And she wanted loyalty of service, but not subservience intellectually.
Now, you were actually, if I have the chronology correct, inside the White House in the NSC during the period when the Iraq war was decided upon.
Yeah.
And then you moved over to become Assistant Secretary.
Yeah, during the second term.
So what was that like? People talk a lot now about Trump. Is he blowing up the interagency process and, the regular decision-making? But there's evidence that Bush sort of bypassed that process in making the decision to go to war in Iraq anyways. What was it like to be there at that time?
I was not part of that decision-making process. I was responsible for trying to assemble as big a coalition as we could get so we wouldn't do it alone. After 9/11, there was kind of an inner war cabinet established. And there were a number of, frankly, bad decisions made. And I think if you read Condi Rice's memoirs closely, you will see that she recognizes that. But I will say this. These were bad decisions made in the wake of 9/11. That wasn't made up.
Where were you on 9/11? Were you in the White House?
I was in the White House. I was in when the second when the news of the second plane hitting the the towers came through. I was in the regular senior staff meeting, and the word came through. Condi Rice stood up, dismissed the meeting, and things went into motion. I saw the vice president being evacuated. It was a bad day. I spent several hours that day in the Situation Room helping out, but I didn't have a particularly important role. I was just doing what I could. 9/11 was a genuine trauma, and President Bush rallied the country. I think the Iraq War was ill-considered, but there it was done in the wake of a national trauma. And that the errors made under such circumstances are different than errors made in the cold.
So coming back to the cold, Russia today, this current controversy here in Washington may be a lasting one or not, we don't know, but it certainly risks papering over what's happening in Russia itself and in Europe with the expansionist tendencies that you now see in Russia, which was not the case just a few years ago.
Russia is an aggressive revisionist power, and they are working, there's evidence they're working to interfere not just in our electoral process, but the electoral processes of Europeans with the same toolkit. Money, fake news, propaganda, what the Soviets used to call aktivnye meroприятия, active measures. This is serious.
Well, you've talked about, I mean, not just those kind of measures, but also poisonings, killings, assassinations.
Yeah, they have. This is also what the Soviets did.
If you Google Dan Fried and WikiLeaks, you will find that the one thing that came up that got a lot of attention was a cable in which you discussed the poisoning of Litvinenko in Great Britain. And that was obviously an early indicator, perhaps, of the more aggressive outside-the-country measures that the Russians were taking. You said in this account that was included in these cables that you believed that Putin was a very hands-on leader of the country, and that he would not have, something like that wouldn't have happened probably without his knowledge.
WikiLeaks, I will neither confirm nor deny, but I certainly will not discuss the contents of a cable that shouldn't have been leaked. But I'll say this, that the character of Russian aggression has been clear to a number of us for some years. And I'm not one of these people that believes that Russia is doomed or somehow, inevitably disposed to act according to its worst traditions. But all the more reason, therefore, to resist their aggression and take it seriously. Russia could be, in fact, it would have to be a different Russia, but could be a splendid ally, I will say this for the Russians, in their favor. They have the intellectual capacity and the habits of mind to act in the world on a strategic scale. And were they to do so in service of a better cause than their current set of grievances, they would be a natural partner. And to that degree, the Trump administration is right. But don't mistake the Russia you want to exist for the Russia that there actually is. Be realistic.
Well, you talked in your going away speech, and that's a good way to bring it back, about the so-called realists. Your critique of them basically is that they have an unrealistic view of Russia.
Well, the realism is important in foreign policy. You have to be realistic about what you can achieve and about the pitfalls and problems along the way, of which there are plenty. Nothing is easy. It's always rough. Be careful about a policy generated with enthusiasm in the rush of a moment. It usually doesn't turn out well. But I'm talking about, in my speech, I was talking about realism as a foreign policy doctrine. which means basically you don't care about values, you consider them a luxury, and it leads to a kind of acquiescence in spheres of influence. Now, spheres of influence sound good if you're a graduate student or a certain kind of an academic with a certain habit of mind. But in fact, spheres of influence don't work out very well, certainly not for the victims, and there are always victims. But they don't work out for the great powers in the end, because no great power is ever satisfied with its sphere of influence. You know, they never are.
But you've seen many secretaries of state who are seduced by this idea that they're going to have this grand sort of Kissingerian grand bargains and deals between great powers. Arguably, even your most recent secretary, John Kerry, was attracted to that vision of diplomacy.
Oh, John Kerry tried to work with the Russians on Syria, and the man was honorable, because he was trying to do the right thing and, frankly, playing a very weak hand, a hand that was weak not because of him, okay? He did the best he could. But I will say this, to his enormous credit, he never offered a dirty deal. You can have Ukraine if you only help us out on Syria. Never. He never did that.
And when you say he was playing a weak hand, that was because you believe that President Obama had constrained him by making so clear that he was not willing to consider other options in Syria.
I remember in that week in which it looked like we were preparing military action in concert with some of our European allies, John Kerry made not one but two speeches in favor of it. It was pretty clear. And those were compelling speeches. That was powerful stuff. And I think he was right. And the fact that we changed our mind meant that his diplomacy was a lot weaker. Diplomacy is not merely talking somebody into something. It's talking to somebody from a position of strength. You put your power on the table to open up the conversation. That's diplomacy. That's when you can have a productive discussion. Secretary Kerry did the best he could. And his stamina and determination is probably responsible for getting us the Iran deal, which I think is certainly in the national interest and a good achievement. So I admire and respect what Kerry was doing. No, I don't think he's guilty of that kind of sphere of influence grand bargain thinking. It's usually attributed to Kissinger, but Kissinger was working in a different era. He was working to manage a Cold War that people thought would go on forever.
So one name that hasn't come up at all is Hillary Clinton. A lot of people think that she was more hawkish, quote unquote, on Russia than Barack Obama, and that there would have been a different policy toward Russia had she come into office. The Russians certainly are more critical of her. What was your view of Hillary Clinton just as a boss and then also on Russia?
She was a wonderful boss. She was a wonderful boss. I'll tell you a story. I had the job. In fact, she gave me the job of being the special envoy for trying to close Guantanamo.
Yeah, you know, that doesn't seem like such a prime job, Dan.
Yeah, it's not a great job. But I will say this for her. She knew when she hired me that I would push hard, that I wasn't going to go through the motions. By God, I would bear down on it. And I pushed. And when I pushed, she backed me all the way. And I am grateful to this day. She didn't have to do that. There are lots of secretaries who send off special envoys and, yes, they do a great job, and that's fine until it costs you something, and then they cut you off. Never. She never did that. She backed me all the way.
Were you aware at the time that this was pretty much of a hopeless cause?
She was aware of it. The trouble is, in foreign policy, you have to mean it. You can't go through the motions. Don't start something if you're not serious. As Napoleon said, if you set out to take Vienna, take Vienna. If you set out to close Gitmo, close Gitmo, which means you're going to have to stare down the opposition. She was willing to do so, but it became clear that the new Obama administration had miscalculated the politics. They thought that because the Bush administration wanted to close Gitmo, which it did, by the way, and because John McCain wanted to close Gitmo, that there was a bipartisan consensus. Well, wrong. That fell foul of politics. and they hesitated. There's more of a story to that. There were some people in the Obama White House like Greg Craig who were determined to do it, and other people, let us say, less determined. And in the end, we did not stare down the opposition, and some of the Republicans smelled weakness. But she backed me all the way, which says something about her. And it was, there was no political profit whatsoever for her to do that. She's sometimes accused of being calculating. There was no profit whatsoever in her support for my efforts to close Gitmo, and yet she backed me up 100% all the way. I'm one of the many people who has said that the Hillary Clinton we know in private was effective, strong, courageous, and funny. And the campaigner we saw was less so, more scripted. Many people have made that observation, and it was my observation too. But I'm grateful for what she did. She didn't have to do that.
So what about her quickly on Russia?
Well, I was there when she gave the misspelled reset button to Lavrov. It was worth a try. I think she was properly careful not to cross any lines. And I do think she was on the more hawkish side. I think that she has an appreciation that American power needs to be put in the service of American values, which is an American tradition and a pretty good one. And I think she was willing to do that. The Russians, it said that Putin can't stand her. I don't know that for a fact, but it certainly looks that way. But I think her approach to Russia stands up pretty well.
So in many ways, we've talked a lot about Russia, but I think it's striking to me that in your goodbye speech, you ended it by coming back to America and your conclusions
sure.
about what kind of a country
sure.
we are. And you said, and I'll read this, America's grand strategy did not come from nowhere. It followed from our deeper conception of ourselves and our American identity. Who are we, Americans? What is our nation? We are not an ethno-state with identity rooted in shared blood. The option of a white man's republic ended at Appomattox.
Yeah. Isn't it odd that simply channeling Lincoln's political thought is regarded as some sort of a statement, but there we are. Lincoln is quoted more often than he's understood, and he understood that the founding principle of our nation is in fact the Declaration of Independence. We are a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. That's what makes us Americans. When we sign on to that belief, we sign on to the core American identity, and that's very deep in us. That makes us who we are, and it means that we are not an ethno-state. We are not rooted in blood and soil. The Civil War was fought, in a sense, over whether that sentence, all men are created equal, is to be taken literally. And the Southerners in the 1850s argued that it was not. And I thought it was important to remind people of that, because our grand strategy doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from that conception of ourselves. We have a deep sense of American equality and opportunity, and that informs the way in which we brought our American power to the world, because we thought that other nations were entitled to that same opportunity in a rules-based system. Now, George Kennan, who is basically a realist as well as one of the great American diplomats of all time, called it our moralistic, legalistic tradition, and he didn't have much use for it. But I disagree. I think that's our glory.
A lot of people thought George Kennan was a greater analyst of the Soviet Union than of the United States.
George Kennan was dead right when he analyzed the Soviet Union and punctured the liberal illusions we had about them. He was dead right, and the containment policy that he articulated, but that Acheson and Truman and Marshall put into effect, was the grand strategy that wins the Cold War two generations later. Absolutely brilliant. That is George Kennan's great contribution. He nailed it. But in terms of understanding our country, Lincoln understood who we are, and then Lincoln redefines the way we think about ourselves, so much so that we assume that that's who we are. No, we think of ourselves that way because Lincoln taught us to think that way. And I wanted to make that point. We are not a white man's republic.
Dan, you came to serve your country 40 years ago in the midst of the Cold War. You leave it with the Cold War having been over for 25 years, but America as or more divided politically than at any time since you've been serving the country. We are grateful, all of us, to you and for sharing this time with us. And I hope that all of you listeners out there will not only thank Dan, but keep listening to The Global Politico and subscribe to our podcast. I hope you'll rate us. And please, anytime, send me an email at sglasser@politico.com giving us feedback, ideas for guests, or just telling us what you thought of the episode. Thanks again.